Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska!
I think it's the best show on the air ever that has been. It's weird how good it is. It's so strange.
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, July 19, 2023, and this is the Bob Seska Interview on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, I'm Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hello. Day 910 of the Biden-Harris administration, 474 days until the 24 presidential election. You can find me on Instagram, TheBobSeska, Twitter, BobSeska_go, Spoutable, Bob Seska, Threads. I think it's TheBobSeska over there, too. Plus, Patreon is BobSeskaShow.com. So we're taking a break from politics today in order to talk with two of my favorite musicians in the entire world, the great Cersei Link and Christian Nesmith, the duo responsible for what's become, at least to me, the greatest prog rock album ever. If you've been listening to the show at all recently, you've heard me praise their album Cosmologica. It's a spectacular volume of music, whether you're a prog aficionado or not, recorded during the COVID quarantine and released in the fall of 2021. It's emotionally gorgeous, musically virtuosic, and literally every track is as great as the next. So today we're doing a deep dive into Cosmologica, and if you like what you hear, go to any of the digital music platforms, Apple Music, Bandcamp, etc., and download this into your record collection right now. Links in the description as always. Meantime, think about supporting this fully independent podcast by subscribing to our Patreon page, BobSeskaShow.com. So this is me acting like a total fanboy with the great Cersei Link and Christian Nesmith.
More fun, more music, the Bob Seska Show.
Cersei, Christian, it's an extreme honor to talk with you today. So thank you for joining me.
We're honored to be here. Thank you so much for digging the record.
So before we dig into the songs themselves, let's talk about origins. We'd be remiss, of course, if we didn't pay our respects to Christian's dad, the iconoclastic Mike Nesmith, of course. Christian, were you encouraged to become proficient in literally every instrument there is, or did you just pick them up on your own?
I think it was a matter of climate, you know. Yeah. There was always music in the house. There was an entire wall full of vinyl, which I had access to at a very early age and was encouraged to listen to anything and everything and did. And so I started on piano, but then, you know, moved over to guitar, having seen Song Remains the Same. And, you know, it was all over when I saw Jimmy up there doing his thing. It's like, man, that's me.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if there was necessarily direct encouragement. It was just the natural thing to happen. I have three other siblings, and we are all musical. And so, yeah, that's
it runs in the family.
It does run in the family. However, yes. I'm not sure, you know, you always get asked the question when you're the offspring of someone famous, is it nature or nurture? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm far more inclined to believe that it is nurture, but most specifically in my case, just because of my surroundings. There was never not music.
It's so rare for someone to be proficient at this level when it comes to just about every rock instrument there is. So
well, proficient is certainly a relative term. and you also have to understand that so much of the instrumentation is done with MIDI programming.
Yeah.
So if to anybody who's familiar with that, there's a timeline that MIDI information in the form of little dots mm-hmm. gets programmed into your song. And so I get to go back and move the dots at will.
Yeah.
So anything that didn't sound all that good, I can then go make it sound as if I were a master.
Yeah, but let me interject. It's still about composition. I mean, yes,
yeah.
The drum parts are difficult and interesting, but you still have to come up with the parts, yeah. You know, write them.
The drum parts were all acoustic, right? I mean, you were playing on a full drum kit. Is that?
No, they're all programmed by me. They're all phony.
Are you serious? Wow. God. Oh my God. The samples have become amazing these days.
Well, I also have experience as a recording engineer. So,
yeah.
To try and get those mixes so it was sounding as live as possible. I also played drums as a kid for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
So, having, you know, Bonham and Peart be, you know, superheroes of mine, even though I wasn't even playing drums by that time, I was able to see inside those players and they, you know, they always inspired me. And
also when you're programming drums, you're thinking like a drummer. So, you know, he'll talk about whether the left hand is stronger or the right hand is, and what the feet are doing if it's a double kick. I mean, he actually goes in and does that idea of composition while he's in there with those little dots and moving them around.
Yeah, yeah.
It's great to watch.
I mean, I was completely fooled because there are dynamics to them. I mean, it doesn't sound like every single snare hit is perfection. It's not like you're down to the micron when it comes to the timing of it. But I mean, obviously, it's all amazing sounding. But if you really pay attention, it has those legitimate imperfections that you would hear, whether it was Neil Peart playing acoustic drums or Bill Bruford or Phil Collins or any a prog musician, you're going to hear those little tiny blemishes in the process that make it sound real. And well, that's what I was picking up, and that's why I was tricked.
You can definitely chalk that up to the software itself. They do things these days called round robin, where they'll take the exact same hit, but you know, have eight of them ready to go that are each a little different, and they will show up randomly,
So Cersei, when did you first fall in love with music and vocals?
Once upon a time, there was a young girl who was born in San Francisco. My mother found me in the park in Haight-Ashbury under a trash can.
You're a feral vocalist found in the wild. Is that it?
Actually, my mom does joke that she found me in the park. She said, yeah, some hippie girl gave me. You know, I was not a musician. I was a painter and a poet for many years before mm-hmm. music hit me in the head and forced me to start doing things in public. And it just kind of came upon me. I always think that creativity is like those cabinets that you close one in the kitchen and the other one pops open.
Yeah.
So for me, creativity is always just wherever the muse directs me is kind of where I go. And it's manifested in so many ways in my life. But I probably didn't start making music until 25 years ago.
Wow.
I met Christian shortly after I started making music.
Gotcha.
She didn't start making real music, actual music, until her 30s. So
yeah, I mean, I started singing my whole life. I've always been someone who'd enjoyed singing, but I was never professionally at all.
Well, tell them the story. You know, the first
I dreamed the first song I ever wrote. Was a little country number, pretty easy peasy. But you know, words, lyrics, the whole thing. I just kind of popped into my mind, and I thought, well, that's fascinating. Maybe I should do something with that. And then another one came like later that day, and then another one came like at dinner time. And
her first three songs she wrote in a day. They're all on the first record, the first Cersei Link record.
Yeah, it's what I like to call cowboy jazz. Totally different than the prog.
Right. That's an incredible thing. That's very John Anderson of you. I've talked with him enough times to realize that his inspiration often comes from dreaming.
Yeah.
We call it the muse.
The muse, yeah. There you go, yeah.
Exactly. And some mornings, if she says, you know, you're going to write a bossa nova song today, we do that. If she says it's going to be a country swing, or if it's going to be prog. But I'll say that Christian and I, always being prog fans, always talked about doing it. And when the lockdown came, we were stuck in the studio, in the house here in our home studio with nothing else to do. So we finally said, okay, let's scale that Everest together while we're quandaring, is that a word? Nice. Having existential quandary about life. And the theme of the record really touches on all that stuff too. So it was fortuitous.
I mean, as a musical project, you two must look at each other and go, my God, when it comes to putting this stuff together, when it comes to writing and recording music, you got everything you need staring right back at you. Is that kind of the sense that you have? I mean, your personal relationship aside, is that kind of the working relationship? Like, boy, Christian can play all these instruments, and Cersei, you're an amazing singer, vocalist, lyric writer, and so on. Holy shit, we should be doing something. Is that kind of how you got started as a couple, or what came first, the songwriting and performing, or you two meeting and kind of hitting it off that way on a personal level?
She sought me out as a player because these three songs that she had written, starting to flesh it out. She went and recorded with a couple of other people, but she wanted to kind of.
Looking for a pedal steel player. Actually,
yeah. So, do you know any pedal steel players? Well, I can hook you up. But then she sent me her three song deal, and I heard immediately that she was the real thing. You know, and reached back out to her. I was actually reticent because I'd been in a lot of sort of acoustic based bands for a while, and I didn't want to do that again. I wanted to get back into more, rock guitar, which is my home base. But Cersei's voice and delivery and songs were so legitimate, genuine, that I couldn't not pay attention. Also, the picture on the front of the there you go.
He's honest.
The interesting thing is that my mother and my father were very responsible for making me appreciate traditional country music. So that's very well ingrained into my soul. And so I turned my mom on to that first three song demo, and she sat on it for a couple few weeks. And by that time, Cersei and I had gotten together as a couple, just starting dating. But when I went over to my mom's she said, this is the woman you're going to be with for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. Having never met her yet, I don't think.
No, she hadn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As Cersei used the word fortuitous. And so in the beginning, though, because it was so raw, we did absolutely needed other players. It was not a studio project. We wanted not it to all. Be more mm-hmm. more of a band, even though we were demoing things out. We had, incredible players like Christopher Alice on drums and
Ian Walker on bass,
and Michael Sherwood on keys and Billy's brother, by the way. So we had an enormous pool of talent to choose from, and they were so generous and so willing to show up for us. So those first few albums
The first few albums more had a Dan Hicks kind of gypsy jazz cowboy thing to it. And because of that, we had to have a certain level of proficiency in the players. I mean, mm-hmm. I will admit I was not up to snuff as a singer. I've grown so much. And I couldn't do the prog record back then. Oh. I can do it now because I've grown so much as a musician. And I think that might be a knock against us because we've hopped genres on every record. I don't know, we've got 12 or 13 records now.
Yeah.
But finally landing in the prog genre has allowed me to expand with lyrics. And again, because of the level of excellence that we're used to with players just the complexity of music that we enjoy making, prog just was such a wonderful fit. I mean, the early stuff is cool too. It was some of it was complicated and hard, but I feel like that this is the place where we were supposed to go.
Well, right. I don't know if the word landing is exactly because you never know what's going to blow our skirt up tomorrow, but truth be told, we are actually working on the second prog record right now.
Oh, yeah. See, you know what? That was one of my last questions. That was one of my questions to ask you as we were wrapping up. And I was thinking, I got to ask them about a sequel. So just jumping way ahead, that's actually going to happen, right?
I wrestled with whether to tell you, but it seemed like a natural segue. So.
Okay, that's outstanding. But just going back, Cersei, going back to your vocals real quick, had you always experimented with vocal harmonies, which are extraordinarily prevalent on Cosmological? Yeah. Was that something that you'd always written with kind of that in mind, or did that emerge as you found your voice strengthening?
Well, I'd never, again, not being a professional and never even thinking about doing music, I just had a natural ear. Always knew how to sing harmonies, annoyingly to some people in the room. one of those people that just, you know, always singing and bugging people with it. But I think Christian, as a producer, was able to elicit performances out of me that I didn't know I had. I was really aping a kind of style in the beginning, you know, kind of Patsy Cline-ish. And he was like, hey, you're not an alto. Did you know that? Let's try this. Let's try this key. Try it in this key. Wow. And up and up and up and up we went. So my natural love of harmony certainly suited me as almost like a compositional tool for him. So a friend of ours who plays with Brian Wilson said that we sound like, what was it, ABBA meets Yes?
Yeah.
Because there's so much really incredible vocal harmony that Christian's able to obviously compose and kind of use me as an instrument in that way. And I love it. I mean, it's pretty natural to me, although sometimes he comes up with some stuff that I'm like, what? That sounds wrong. It's just wrong. And then it sounds amazing once you get it into the mix. So
right. And one thing that's very clear in your work together is you both have extraordinarily good taste. Is that a key component to producing a record?
Well, again, another very subjective word.
Yeah, taste. Yeah. But I mean, in terms of you decide, okay, well, where's this movement going? Where is this heading? And is this too much? Is this overproduced? Or is this not enough? And there's an instinct that goes with music production. So do you feel as though you have that that instinct, that which I call taste, but it's the same thing?
I would like to think so. You know, using these vocals as an example, yes, Cersei was and is a natural singer and a natural harmony singer. And I was hugely influenced by Queen and Elton John and the Beatles and Journey and the way that those bands used vocals, particularly Queen and the Beatles. They used them as another instrument. They weren't just la la la's. They were string parts and horn parts. Mm-hmm. And I've always approached background vocals like that. So I think the taste that you're talking about is an awareness of arrangement.
Yeah.
The ability to put the right instrument, the right sounding color, timbre instrument. And sometimes it's a keyboard and sometimes it's a stack of ahs, you know? And Cersei is so good at you know, stacking up 24, it's Wall of Cersei, you know, 24 vocals singing four part. And so that's a wonderful other instrument to have.
We are lucky that we can use the studio as an instrument because Christian has that engineering background and he mixes everything as well. We record it all, and all of our other stuff is recorded by him as the primary engineer.
I think it kind of goes back to your earlier question, Bob, about that we are kind of a one-stop shop.
I do all the artwork, I do all the website stuff, I do all the admin, paying the band. We're our own tiny little record label.
So that does make it, I don't know about easier, but at least more accessible. When the COVID showed up, we had worked on different sounding records, but
we had Cosmological. The song was already in the can.
That was actually 10 years old. That's the one song that was written almost
about
that long.
10 years ago.
And But I had a whole bunch of other little snips and bits and bobs of ideas that I'd been sitting on that never felt like they belonged anywhere until March 7th of 2020. And mm-hmm. there we were. And it's like, okay, we've got nothing to do for the foreseeable months, yeah. if not years. Let's just get into it because here we sit.
One of the great things to emerge out of the pandemic. If there was anything positive to emerge out of that cataclysm, maybe this album was one of those things. And I say that with all the enthusiasm in the world because it is just a stellar recording. And so you're friends with this amazing circle of musicians. You talked about Michael Sherwood, the late Michael Sherwood.
He's the only one on the record, the only guest on Cosmologica.
Yeah. Was there any consideration at some point that maybe you bring in Michael Sherwood or Paul Mellinson, who I'm a huge fan of, or Robbie Mist, or any of these guys?
Yeah. What a voice, right?
Oh, my God. It's incredible. Yeah.
That's so great that you know Paul.
Right alongside your stuff, I play a lot of Paul's work on my show. I play independent bands coming out of commercial breaks. And that's how I discovered you guys. That's how I discovered Paul. And I know Robbie Rist through Facebook somehow. And Michael Sherwood, he was a reader of my stuff. He followed my podcast and my writing on politics and so on. And so I got to know him also through Facebook. And I had also worked with Billy on a bunch of different things prior to him joining Yes officially. And so I was familiar with both of the Sherwood brothers. And so I was devastated when we lost Michael Sherwood. He died before the pandemic, right?
That's correct. Yeah. Okay. I actually knew Michael since 94, maybe. We became fast musical friends. It was almost immediate. So much so, I don't know if you've heard our record. We made a record. It's called Groovy Lemon Pie.
I haven't heard that. Yeah, I need to listen.
Yeah. It's not the it was done very catch as catch can, so it's not the greatest sounding record, but it is Michael and I one stop shopping together and kind of doing that.
It's brilliant and, songwriting. It's just astounding.
I was I'm still agonized over his death. I miss him so much because he was a partner of mine. As a matter of fact, on the day of his death, a bunch of us who were really tight got together. Are you aware of Danny Peck?
Not right off the top of my head.
Michael played alongside Danny Peck in a local cabaret called Genghis Cohen here in L.A.
Okay.
And for years and years and years, and I walked in and I saw Danny and I said, man, I think I know what Paul felt like in 1980. And Danny said, yeah, there are about, 15 of us who feel like that. And that's what was so amazing about Michael is that his enthusiasm and generosity with his music, was vast. And so while we were making that record, which is odd because, he died before the pandemic, but
we had plans to have him all over that record.
Yeah. But we didn't know that we were going to make that record.
We're going to do a prog thing. Michael will do this. Michael will do that.
But, the interesting thing about his guest performance is that 17 years into Cersei and I's relationship, we got married here in our apartment. And it was just a little close hang. And Michael was there and he was the last person to leave, which was of course. But towards the end of that evening, we didn't make a big to-do about out of their ceremony, but I opened up a thing that I'd been kind of kicking around. It was a section of a song, and I said, Mikey, blow a solo on this, which we had no idea where it was going to wind up or how it was going to turn out, but he did, right here in this room that we're sitting in now. And that's the solo that you hear.
So that's on God from the Machine. That's the last track on Cosmologica. Right. And he played that. Was that an actual Hammond, or you just play it on a synth?
No, it's a virtual instrument. But yeah,
incredible. Virtual. Yeah,
and
yeah.
That was the last time Chris was on.
And so he never got to hear Cosmologica. He never got to hear. I mean, all of those synth solos that I do that are so Emerson and Wakeman inspired. Michael, I wish you were here so you could hear this or help me make it better, you know?
Yeah.
So we both, and also Cersei did an entire record with him.
I did. Yeah, it's not out. It's in the can, just sitting around.
Oh, but, my God.
Yeah, this crazy, I don't know, what would you call it, babe?
It's kind of jazz. We're getting into our Steely Dan vibes and really going for that sort of thing. But I would say that Michael was really influential for me coming on the scene with no experience with music at all. And he was so great to work with. He would not discriminate against anybody. I had written two songs and he was like, let me check it out. Cool. This is great. Let's talk about songwriting. He was so generous and his understanding of just that exchange between two artists really informed me as a songwriter and a lyricist. Yeah.
He was one of the most gargantuan lyricists you ever heard. He was just incredible.
Wow.
So often when I'm writing, and in particularly the prog stuff, because prog, I think, gives you a parameter to write wider than traditional, you know, regular old rock songs, I think about him all the time. He's, you know, I'm having a discussion with him like, oh, he'd get a kick out of this, or he'd say, push yourself. You could do better than that.
And similar frames of reference insofar as, I mean, especially you, Christian, you and Michael both come from musical families. I mean, Michael's dad, Billy's dad, was a performer. And obviously Billy has made a significant name for himself in rock music and being in Yes and having his own projects and so on. It's a lot of overlap, a lot of commonality between you guys. But
Michael was never reticent to talk about his dad and the jokes that he made and the lessons he learned. Bobby Sherwood was a huge composer and arranger for, you know, the Vegas crew back when Sinatra and Sammy Davis and all those guys were doing their thing. He was right in the middle of all of that.
So, Cersei, which came first, the concept for Cosmologica, sort of an examination of the universe and existence, or was it the music itself? How did the initial spark, the initial seed of this thing get started, beyond having Cosmologica floating around for years as a song? How did the concept for this piece begin? How did that get started?
Well, again, the lockdown, I think, really presented some stark topics to contemplate if one was doing any sort of existential navel gazing at the time, and I certainly was. So thinking about the convergence of technology, humanity, survival of those things, also the actual idea of being stuck inside and that there was a barrier. Even when I go see my mom or any of us going and visiting relatives, like, are we visiting through glass? It was like being inside this spaceship and knowing that outside there, it could be deadly. It was dangerous for everybody. And so it just presented itself. And again, that's kind of how the muse shows up for me. It just shows up, and whether it's in dream or whether it's just something that hits me while I'm walking down the street, these ideas just flow all the time for me. And it just seems so obvious.
The specific answer to your question, Bob, is that we had a collection of musical ideas. Some were more fleshed out than others. And as we were kind of, you know, poking at it and seeing where it would go, about a third of the way into working on it, Cersei went, okay, found it.
Yeah, 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 sure.
Found it. I know what I'm going to talk about. And once she did, it was off to the races. We just really knew how to go. Because I can only get so far as having, you know, musical motifs and connect parts. But without that lyrical glue, they're just not going anywhere.
Well, sometimes he'll be working on something and I'll hear it and I'll run in and I'll say, oh, that should be called this.
Yeah.
And then whatever that word is, like architecture was like that. I ran in and I said, oh, I got something for this. Mm-hmm. He said, okay, great. So he kind of finishes his sketch, gives it to me. And then I kind of write lyrics, come up with a little bit of a melody and then come back to him. And then we start building it from there. So it's definitely, a really beautiful collaboration. Early on, my stuff was, I would come up with a melody and a lyric, I'd bring it to him, and he would flesh out all the music.
Right, right.
And I didn't really play any instruments at all. I mean, I play guitar now terribly, but, but stay away from the guitar, Cersei.
Yeah, and it's not like putting hammer to a nail. It sounds like it was a really non-linear process where you're layering things and coming back to ideas and maybe abandoning things. Is that kind of how it went? Or did you start with acoustic jams? I mean, what was the overall process for assembling these pieces? Is it something that happened in your place and you're just jamming this stuff out, or was it a sort of a studio construction process? I mean, I'm speaking in generalities, basically, but the kind of through line for the entire process, was it a more construction kind of thing, or was it more organic, starting with seeds of ideas?
Because Prague is sort of modular, you know, I would have a whole bunch of ideas. I mean, I was sitting on this. Oh, I am in the wrong tuning.
Different guitar, honey. We have so many guitars, so many tunings.
I'm so happy to hear it. I was just like, for a second, I was like, is he going to play guitar for me? This is amazing.
Yeah, it's this guy.
Yeah.
You know, that's the opening to the God Machine.
Yeah.
And I've been sitting on that little thing because because it feels good to play under my fingers, and I sort of fleshed that out. But where that would go, we didn't have any idea. And so there were, about a dozen of those things, mm-hmm. or maybe a little bit more. And then I just tried my best to sort of imagine what a vocal would be like, and would string a few of those parts together. Then Cersei would take a run at it, and it would be clear that there would there was some editing that would needed to be done. Mm-hmm. And so I would edit my stuff to more acclimate. Then she would come back and have something that was a little more closer to where we were going to go. And then I've always been kind of the closer.
Call it, then he fixes what I did.
Well, that's really the job of a producer. I mean, one of the many layers to what you do. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, for real, having him as a producer, he knows what he wants. I've seen so many other artists in the studio, and they don't know what they want, and that mm-hmm. is not only really expensive, but frustrating sometimes for players and for them. So maybe that production that you hear, or that instinct that you hear, is the fact that he really knows what he wants to hear.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I also think sort of cinematically. That I want the song to have a dramatic arc to it. Mm-hmm. So the explosions are really big, and the drops are really really significant, and I remember an interview with Eddie Van Halen right at the beginning, and he in Guitar Player magazine, and he said, what I want with my music is to very gently reach out and lift my listener's chin up ever so slightly and go bam.
Yeah, exactly.
And hit him in the face. Mm-hmm. And so that setup, if you'll listen, hopefully I'm doing it right, or doing what I'm intending to do, which is giving the listener a little setup. So when the payoff hits, when that crash comes, mm-hmm. When that chord change comes, that they're it's something unexpected, but they're ready for, if that makes any sense. I don't
know.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It's, I had this conversation with, coincidentally, Billy Sherwood, where we were talking about, it was back during the loudness wars. I'm sure you both remember where everyone would compress the hell out of their recordings to the point where
it's
just, yeah. Well, and we were talking about that, and he said something that was kind of revelatory. He said, you know what, the key to great music, especially prog music, is dynamics. And that's something you hear in a lot of his work, especially, but it's all over Cosmologica. The dynamics of this album, I mean, you can really hear the ups and the downs and the cinematic quality of it that you were just describing, Christian.
Yeah. Thank you, Bull. Thank you for noticing. That's what we're shooting for.
I think also transitions are hugely important, not just in, you know, your average songwriting stuff of getting from a chorus to a bridge, but even more so in Prague. I think of it like, and I know Christian does as well, it's like a classical piece of music in the sense that those transitions have to make sense. They have to let the listener go on that journey. If you're telling a story, it's got to have sections and components to an emotional content. And with your composition, you can really make that happen for them.
Yeah.
It's also interesting that, you know, to set out to make a quote Prague unquote record is rather lofty, you know? And something, you know, I never played Yes covers. I was always, an Aerosmith and Rush kind of guy. Mm-hmm. Although Rush at least helped me out with a lot of the more.
But you can sit down and play Close to the Edge on the acoustic
guitar.
No, I can't.
Yes, not Close to the Edge and You and I.
No, I'm talking about the whole record.
No, I can't.
I've seen you do it.
No, you haven't.
I bet he can. I'm with Cersei on this.
You haven't. No, I haven't. I said it's a complete, total lie. I cannot do that. Don't anybody call me up and challenge me to do that, because I can't.
All right. Well, my hallucination is that he has an encyclopedic amount of information and of music in his mind that he can't sit down and play. It's so
right,
much
right.
Going for something that is... by definition, Prague, there's certainly a vocabulary that you're looking for.
Yeah.
Something that is, one can certainly identify Genesis and ELP and Gentle Giant and King Crimson and, you know, all your big famous Prague bands as Prague. So what is it about those bands? Truth be told, I make no bones about nodding towards the influences of where those things come from. If you hear a guitar sound that sounds like Steve Howe, well, that was intentional. You know?
Yeah.
If you hear a synth solo that sounds like it was Keith Emerson, I meant to do that. And I'm not ashamed of that at all, because those guys are, you know, they are the giants upon whose shoulders we stand.
Exactly.
I actually put that sentence in the right order.
Good job, honey. We actually had a review in, what was the magazine in the UK? I can't remember. The reviewer said, I hope you don't take this as an insult, but that was the best Yes record of the year. And I said, man, that's great. Sometimes I wander around and I'm looking for a melody and I think, WWJAD, what would John Anderson do?
One last question before we actually talk about some of the tracks individually is, Cersei, do you consider this to be a concept album, or is this merely a thematic through line without an overarching narrative? How do you peg this?
I think the latter. We do have a concept record that tells a whole story that we've done, and that's lovely.
Which is called Bird's Amazing Odyssey and the Meaning of Tea.
Yes.
Go check it out.
I love it.
It's unusual. But yeah, I think it's more thematic for me. I wanted to tell, I wanted to have some really juicy concepts in there. So I relied on some of my great loves of reading, like Philip K. Dick, Kurt Vonnegut, and Virginia Woolf, Heinlein. Yeah, particularly for the sci-fi stuff.
Yeah.
And the interiority that someone like Woolf gives you. So
it should be noted as an aside, Cersei reads over 100 books a year.
I'm a reader.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That is amazing. I'm so jealous of that, Cersei. Well, I wish I had the time. Yeah.
Yeah, you just got to make it, man.
Yeah.
But I think lyrically, I wanted to make sure that I was touching on some really interesting concepts. Like I even explore a little bit of the whole clockmaker, the divine clockmaker, the whole Dawkins idea.
Yeah.
And then contrast that with agnosticism versus atheism when you're thinking about those greater themes and where you stand in the universe. So I just think the whole thing is thematic. That's a really good way to put it.
So did you approach Suborbital Preflight as sort of an overture for the piece? Is that the idea behind the opening instrumental?
It was the last thing that we did. Do you know Mark McCrite?
The name sounds familiar. Refresh my memory.
He's been around. He's a huge prog head. He's a good friend, and I really trust his ears.
Yeah.
So he was one of the couple people that we were playing this for as we were getting close to the end, and what we started with was architecture, and he said, "It seems awfully early to have vocals just come right in for a prog record."
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, you're right. So I sat down and I tried to just say, okay, let's just make this grand overture to start the record that is all instrumental, and that's what popped out. And I, truth be told, I don't remember the process of that particular song. It just went, okay, let's go. And I just kind of spit it out. And then as I sort of fleshed it out, I wanted to nod to a couple of little motifs that are going to show up later in the record.
Yeah.
As I don't sure does.
It's kind of amazing to say this about any prog song, but I get the feeling that there's at least some restraint to it. And what I mean by that is a lot of modern prog tends to fall into the category of shredding for the sake of shredding is how I describe it. But this doesn't have that, but this isn't that. I mean, this has got a lot of virtuoso playing in it, but with this, there is that level of restraint. So you don't cross that line, which is amazing.
Well, I definitely have a response to that. You know, I'm a pretty good guitar player, but you know, I am definitely not. Oh God, what is the guitar player? Petucci? No. Who's the Dream Theater guy? You know.
Oh, good. Oh, God,
that guy. Anyway,
yeah,
that guy.
Exactly. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
And this guy, you know, and all those types of players, they have enormous facility with their instrument, and I never quite got that far. So the fact that it didn't go into full-on math rock is really just a limitation of my own ability. Sometimes I wish that I could do more. You know, Steve Morse is a huge hero of mine, but I've never been able to play close to the technical proficiency.
I think those limitations, though, are what make different artists unique and cool. I mean, I would have loved to have been, you know, Sarah Vaughan or Patsy Cline with my voice, and I'm not. And it's great that I'm not, because I got to become who I am and develop my own style of singing that's unique.
I will say, though, that one of the I gotta see if I can get a pick out here. One of the biggest things that happened was I got an instrument called a Griffin. It's a small 12 string high tuned instrument, that's it, you know, and it's this little teeny thing, and you can hear it all over the record. You know, it's like right, so you can hear that, and it's this thing, and this has been such a gigantic inspiration for
instrumental.
Me. Instrumental. It's been instrumental in my instrumentation, and I love this thing, and so it, as you can tell, the record opens with it, so I wanted to bring that up. But other than that, quite often it's just kind of stringing parts together.
Yeah,
it's just like plop, plop, plop. You know, this block goes there and that block goes there. And do we go back to the old block? No, new thing now.
Did you each perform the Mission Control voices at the end?
Yes.
Yeah. Have some fun with that?
Yeah. Yes.
Yes, we do have fun.
I love that. I love that so much. And that, of course, takes us into architecture. I assume this is about the great questions of the universe, right, Cersei?
Absolutely.
I mean, the blind watchmaker, are we dreaming? Where do you land on some of these questions personally? Do you have any sort of specific ideas that you lean toward?
One time, there was a little girl who was born in a forest in San Francisco. You know, I think the concept of God is ineffable for me. And the best things in the world, I think, are Wittgensteinian in the idea that they can't be put into language.
Yeah.
And so the folly of doing so is delightful and fun. And I believe that music and art and poetry and dance are the only things that can come close to describing these awesome, and I mean that in the word, what it really means, the awe that it inspires, these ineffable concepts. Mm. Only us artists and the people that get to grok what we're saying are the ones that can come even close to experiencing it together and getting that message across. So I'm not answering your question.
But I mean, are these concepts the architecture that you're singing about? Is that what you're saying?
I guess so. We recently watched a documentary on the Hubble, and is it structure? Kind of looks like structure, but at the same time, it doesn't look like structure. It looks like
chaos.
Earth and chaos. Yeah, and beauty. And so that's definitely the question that I'm asking there, and it's for people to make that decision themselves.
Right. And so that leads us to track number three on the piece, S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y. It's pronounced syzygy, right? Am I pronouncing syzygy?
Yeah.
All right. What does syzygy mean?
It is three celestial bodies that coexist.
That line up.
Well, not necessarily in a line, but they coexist. So in this case, sun, moon, earth.
So it's a little triptych.
I believe it's the only word in the English language that has three Y's as its only vowels. So
interesting. Yeah. It's I love the word. What a great song title. I was surprised there hadn't been song titles using syzygy in the past. It's, you guys landed on something for the very first time, and it's an awesome concept. I mean, it's the only track on the album that has movement titles, which is a kind of a classic prog trope, one for each of the three movements, Terra Firma, Sol, Lunaria, which, as you said, Earth, Sun, and Moon, right?
Yep. Yeah. The Terra Firma actually was sort of my concept. And where it came from, I know the actual origin is I always loved the sound of the wood elves in Lord of the Rings. In the first Lord of the Rings movie, the four hobbits are, or maybe it's just the two of them at that point, they're just cruising through the forest right towards the beginning, and they see the wood elves walking through, and there's this beautiful female-based choral chant that they're doing, and I just always love that, and it shows up in other places. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to kind of make a nod to that, and so that's what that first movement was.
Out beyond my fingertips is the infinite of space. Between the stars and worlds, we are reaching. Beyond the sacred skin in which I have been placed. Between the souls of others, we are seeking. And let me touch the earth again in green and mother blue. Let me live with you again on the rosy fields of Terra Firma.
And then the solar, you know, obviously I wanted something that was
I love that section.
I do too.
yeah,
that was
it's
really
so heavy.
That was not cacophonous, but certainly as angry as a blazing sun.
Yeah.
So I just happened on this little keyboard riff that you hit, that you hear at the beginning, and said, and then what would that sound like if I played it on heavy guitar? And so it morphs into that. And
is that, that's the section that has the Carmina Burana section in it.
I mean, again, once again, we're hearing the dynamics of progressive rock writ large in this particular song. Mm-hmm. And of course, I just love everything about this track. But the anthem, my favorite part of the song is the anthem in Lunaria.
There you go.
Which
is it's just chills inducing every time. Both recording this and let's say Cersei, you're laying down your vocals, do you ever stop and go, holy shit, this is fucking incredible? I mean, when you hit those sort of emotional musical climaxes, it must have been mind-blowing.
You know, that's interesting. I don't generally when we're tracking, because Christian and I are serious game face, race face. We're working. Mm-hmm. And there's a really interesting approach to art, and you have to be able to have the craft as well as the inspiration. And so Christian and I are huge worshipers of craft, you know?
Yeah.
So it's later that I'll hear it and go, oh, you know what? That's really cool. I'm very happy with that. I love that. Or if I get goosebumps from it, it's usually once I've put my recording hat to the side and now I can be the listener.
Yeah, I'm a little bit more like what you're talking about, Bob, as it starts to unfold, because I'm sitting here in front of the computer and she's next to me on the mic. And as I hear her vocals stack up and I hear the interweaving parts start to really bloom, I'm like, okay, we got it. We hit it, you know, because if you don't get that feeling, you got to go, okay, it's not there yet.
Yeah. Why am I not feeling that way?
Yeah.
That takes us next to Assignment in Eternity, which has, again, another amazing anthem, but this time it's in the middle section, the Sail the Skies to Somewhere Else.
Yeah.
Just, oh my God, it's another emotional climax. The other thing I wanted to mention, too, about this particular track is, and I think it's in the liner notes as well, the drums at the end are a tribute to the late Neil Peart, right?
Yeah, as best as I could do. Yeah.
It doesn't feel derivative. It doesn't feel obvious. You have to be paying attention, and you have to, I guess, be literate in the history of progressive rock to pick up on some of those things. So it is subtle in a sense.
Well, I mean, I listened to 2112, Farewell to Kings, Hemispheres. I'm blanking on the one right after that, Spirit of Radio record.
Permanent Waves.
Permanent Waves and Moving Pictures. I listened to those six records just till my eyes cross, and I can still play almost all of the songs on all of those records. And one of the things that I enjoyed listening to so much was the crafting of Neil's parts.
Yeah.
It was clear that every single strike was chosen on purpose, and that he worked on it, and my suspicions were confirmed later in his interviews. So that I definitely went into it with, you know, WWNPD, man, you know, a rather lofty goal. And I don't know. I mean, I suppose it comes across, but also to address your earlier comment about this song, when that section hits, the one that is a payoff for you.
Yeah.
What's funny about that is that's just the beginning chords, in another key and halftime. Wow.
Oh, that's incredible.
It's all in D at the beginning. And actually, the what are the lyrics at the very beginning?
I don't know.
That big three-part harmony that is a cappella at the beginning, that was actually...
Oh, is that...
I've been going slowly. I've been thinking quickly. I've been knowing only thoughts worth finding, asking now. I've been sowing slowly. I've been thinking quickly. I've been brightly glowing, thoughts for growing, turning fastly.
But the thing is that was actually taken from the guitar part. We decided to say, okay, let's take that guitar part, turn it into an a cappella thing, mm-hmm. and stick it on the beginning. So the big gigantic entrance of the band that you hear right after that a cappella is the first part of the song that was written. When you get into the slower part, that was just after that, the arpeggiating guitar part, that's straight King's X, you know.
Wow.
It should be said that those guys, particularly Ty, has been friends of mine since the Dogman album, for 30 years.
Good friends.
And they're
good
just
guys.
Dear, sweet friends of mine. Talk to them all the time. And I was a fan of theirs before we became friends. So Ty's sensibility of guitar, one of the reasons why we became friends is that, ironically enough, we both loved the open string arpeggiated movements that Alex Lifeson would do. Right. So he would build a part like the verse in Limelight, where he's always bouncing off that open B string. It is so signature Alex. That resonated with both Ty and I, and so Ty and me. I'm the object, right?
You know, the overlap, if you're creating a Venn diagram between Cosmologica and Rush, one of the things that I noticed specifically is the fact that I think one of the hallmarks of Rush music is, while I'm sure each one of the members of that band, Alex, Geddy, and Neil, could play fast and could potentially shred if they wanted to, it's more for them, and even with Neil Peart, who's widely regarded as being the greatest rock drummer of all time, the thing with him, and I have this conversation with my drummer brother all the time, he says, you know what? It's not just about his talent for playing. It's about his creativity behind the drums. His composition, exactly right. Yeah. And that's the Venn diagram overlap with Cosmologica. Because I know that you could probably do it, Christian. I know you could probably shred, going back to our earlier conversation. But I think it's the compositional creativity of the playing that
There are a few moments in the record that have some sort of acrobatic guitar in there, and I'm pretty proud of that stuff. But you're dead on it. Rush's sensibilities, particularly in that second period of theirs, where they really started going for the extended songs. It was important for them to have some sort of linear aspect to it, and so that they could get from the beginning of the song to the end. So mm-hmm. if you listen to Cygnus Part Two, Hemispheres, the first side, there are motifs and there are themes which they continue to call up, to morph, to change. And Cersei made a point earlier. Prog music really is rock and roll, or is classical music with rock instruments.
Yeah.
And so because of that, there are no rules as far as tempo changes, as far as key changes, time signatures. All is fair game. You're not limited to this 3 or 4 minute pop, formula.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but yet, in order to have something that really takes you on a journey, if you're going to attempt to do something that is 8, 10, 15, I still think probably close to the edge, the song itself mm-hmm. might be the benchmark of all prog songs.
Yeah, okay.
When it comes to that. Mm-hmm. And you'll notice how they'll take a theme and morph it a little bit, come back to another theme. So that was really a template which I needed to use in order to make sure that I was composing well.
Yeah. And I got the sense with Cosmologica, the next track on the album I want to talk about, is that song has kind of, and it's not, again, it's not exactly, you can't specifically overlap one song on top of this, but it has that close to the edge kind of more serene middle section. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's got that more of that three act structure that we kind of get in Syzygy, but obviously in this case without the movement titles, but it does have that break in the middle, which is kind of, once again, another prog trope that I think Close to the Edge may have established. I think they were the first, I think Yes were the first ones to do that, where you start out pretty heavy and then you go into something that's more moody and surreal, and then you're back into the themes again.
Galleries of books, ex-libris likes the look of my faraway eyes. Tinsel and stars, this car is my equal inside.
Cosmologica started out as an exercise, and I actually had to open up the file in front of me. Its working title, or the very, something that I put down right at the very beginning, it was called Southern Wondrous. Gee, why did I call it that? Well, it's South Side of the Sky and Wondrous Stories, isn't it?
Amazing. Oh, yeah. You know what? South Side of the Sky actually has that same structure, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so, again, I make no bones about, or I'm not trying to hide the fact that it was inspirational mm-hmm. to me. And being that was the first song that we did, and being 10 years prior to any of the other things, at that time, it was done for an exercise. It's like, okay, let's just see
let's
if
do
I
a prog song.
Let's see if I can do this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So we've actually done that several times. Mm-hmm. One of the other exercises that we've done from time to time, if you've ever heard our cover record, is we've done hyper accurate recordings of classic songs. We did Good Vibrations. We did
Your Move.
Your Move. Although that, I believe that's in another, we put it in a different key. Okay. And then one of the other, Stone in Love and mm-hmm. things like that. Right. And so, yes, I copied it exactly, precisely. I mean, even down to the way that Neil Sean bends his strings on those solos.
Oh, what about the Dance on the Volcano that you did with Shecky?
Yeah, have you ever looked at, go look up my Dance on a Volcano. That's Michael Sherwood singing, and it's on my YouTube channel. And I had the exercise to go and do Dance on a Volcano, which might be my most favorite prog song of all time.
Is it really?
I think so, yeah. Wow. I mean, it's just... So perfect.
Yeah, mine is Awaken. Yes is a big epic from Going for the One. You know, my main band, as you can probably tell, is Rush. But when it comes to Yes, man, it's Awaken to me was the high watermark of Yes epic, you know, long form songwriting. But I mean, along those lines, when Yes first started recording longer tracks, Bill Bruford famously complained about the process and how he had no idea where Close to the Edge was going to end. Did you ever run into that issue with some of the longer tracks on this, especially going back years with Cosmologica? Did you ever wonder, okay, well, we're 2/3 of the way through this track. How does this thing end? Or was it all sort of preconceived?
All the time. Almost every single one of them is like, you know, I'll get it. And that's actually kind of the mark, as you say, is about 2/3. Okay, it's like I've got all my pieces out. I've even got like the down section and, you know, okay, so how the hell do I finish this, you know?
Right.
But I think that's an interesting observation. Good literature proposes that same issue, that same problem arises, because how do you end a great story without without relying on a platitude and happily ever after? So I think that's an incredible challenge for every song. Every good story is figuring out a way to come to a close, and it's hard. That's definitely one of the hardest parts.
So Satellite, is this the love song on the album?
Yeah, I think it is. I was trying to think about, at the time, again, being in the lockdown, about the people that we do love, that do lead the way with the light, and how important that is, not only in one-on-one relationships, but culturally, how important it is to have someone leading the way that says, I got you.
Yeah.
Let's do this. Let's stay positive. Let's work our way out of this. Yeah, it's a bumpy time, but you're always guiding me. And so I know the person who's keeping that light will hopefully show us the way out. So that's a good way to put it. A love song.
Yeah.
But maybe agape instead of eros.
Yeah, as we tumble through the stars and being kept company by a satellite, and in our case, the moon itself. That's what when I hear this song, that's what I think of. Like, okay, we're hurtling through the cosmos, our star system and our galaxy, and we don't have many immediate neighbors, any companions in this journey, but there's the moon, and we can always look up and see, well, we're all this insanity, but there's the moon, and that's so nice. Yeah.
You totally got it. And again, for those of us that were trapped in the house with just our partner and our spouse, I felt so incredibly fortunate
that
Christian and I are best friends. At no point were we ready to kill each other because we were stuck here. We were like, man, I couldn't do this with anybody else but you.
Yeah, we were so grateful that it was each other that we had to spend that time with.
Yeah.
So in God from the Machine, I'm hearing something maybe about AI in this one. Is that an element here, or am I just reading too much into it?
No, you're got it. You've definitely picked up on all the lyrics.
I've listened to the album a few times, Cersei.
I can tell. You know, it's so rare that people pick up on the lyrics. It's funny because before I was a musician, I think I related to lyrics more because I was coming from a poetic standpoint. But I'm not sure that people dig in really deep all the time. And so it's flattering when someone notices that there's a reference to, Philip K. Dick or Heinlein or whatnot. And God from the Machine, Deus Ex Machina, is the idea of, is it going to rescue us? Mm-hmm. Is it going to kill us? Did we make it? Did it make us? Those questions that are profound that we're asking now as we all are on the precipice of this technological age. We're barely at the infancy of it. How's it going to change us?
Yeah. And with AI, with both of you as musicians, you must be deeply concerned with how that's going to manifest itself in music in particular. Because
Not really.
No.
Really?
Your quote, babe, you've been saying lately.
Oh, yeah. Well, Chat GPT can make content. It can't make art.
Okay.
And I feel that that was a very profound quote.
I stole it from somebody. I wish I knew who.
I actually tried to get ChatGPT to write a script just as a lark, and I prompted the hell out of it, and the script was just junk. It was just terrible. Yeah. I tried to get it to write a song,
mm-hmm. a prog song,
no less, and it was just junk. Yeah. But I find it sort of interesting, and I hope that this changes, that what we call so much of our input these days is content, content creators. And I find that so much of it is about as profound as what ChatGPT is producing. It's unfortunate, but we're in a new era over the last 5 years, with particularly with the TikTok format taking off as hard as it is. Mm-hmm. But I'm hoping that that people will see the art to be had in these formats. I also teach. I teach kids how to play rock and roll.
Oh wow, you nailed it.
And what I'm continually pleasantly surprised about is that these kids are not thinking in sound bites. Mm-hmm. They are looking. First of all, they continue to look to the classics because they can instinctively know that so much of the content that is put out these days is shallow and vapid.
Well, it's disposable.
There's a reason why Led Zeppelin and Beatles have sustained for 50, 60, you know, it's going to be almost 70 years soon, you know. It's insane. But these kids are hip to it. They're they're just at their core. They want. I had a 13-year-old kid come in. I let them suggest songs that they were going to do for the semester. And one of the kids came up, he's 13-year-old bass player. And he goes, "Can we do an Iggy Pop song?" Yeah.
That's amazing. Kids asking for the Stooges, huh?
You know it.
Oh,
you
my
know
God. That's incredible. And Christian, I got to ask you about the bass playing on this album, because I'm a bass player and I'm a huge fan of Geddy Lee and Chris Squire and John Entwistle, and the great bass players. And fortunately, I got to meet and hang out with Chris Squire, and he was just as amazing as you could imagine. This particular song, God from the Machine, this one has an interesting, if there is any Chris Squire influence in the bass playing on this particular song, it's actually one of my favorite eras of Yes music, which is actually the Rabin era of Yes in the 1980s. I hear a bit
nailed
of
it. You're so on it.
Hold
you're,
on. You're, is this hold I on from 9125?
Your ears are wide open, man. That's great.
I'm so glad, because I was awesome. I was nervous because when you bring up Rabin era Yes, sometimes it's a little divisive, and so I wanted
to. No. I don't care much for Big Generator, but 90125 is so just
masterpiece.
Awesome,
yeah,
man.
It's a masterpiece.
It is. excuse me. So to have that bass come in and be very simple but very strong. Just, it should be said that Squire is the inspiration, hands down, across the whole record. That's He's certainly my favorite bass player of all time. His tone, his choices, his ability to work his way up the neck and take us to that next place. But you hit it. For me to just go bump, go gunk, 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 gunk. Right. And just pocket into that 6/8 groove.
Yeah.
It was important to me to make that happen. And, uh, It should be said, when that same 6/8 groove switches to double time at the end, that's a direct nod to Kevin Gilbert. And so if your audience is listening and you know, those who know, you know, about Kevin Gilbert. He was incredible. And so that, it's one of the songs on Shaming of the True. And where it's right in the middle of the record, and he shifts from that slow 6/8 to the fast 6/8. I was like, man, that's bitching. I got to use that. That's so cool. And this song happened to support that.
Is there any aspiration to perform this entire thing live? Is there any plans?
Yes,
I dream about it. I just love. But the thing is in order to get it represented, it requires a more musicians than we can afford right now. But I actually went around because I'm been talking to a couple of people, and there was enough of a just a little bit of tickle in their craw to say maybe we can. And so I started looking at it, and I think that there might be a way to play a good percentage of these tunes live. But you know, we're at this point, you know, we are all recovering from various things that are COVID related. Also, the death of my father it still has a fallout in resolving the estate and, you know, that kind of stuff. So to take the time and sort of put that effort into what it would take to get everybody in a room, because it's not going to happen in a day. Everybody's going to have to practice and practice a lot.
What would you play? Oh, I'm sorry, Cersei, go ahead.
I think we're definitely ruminating upon it, and I think we will try and approach it eventually. If nothing else, maybe doing a streaming version of it once we can figure out how to get everybody monitoring together.
You get Paul Melanson and Robbie Rist for background vocals to harmonize with you, Cersei. And I see, I've got this all worked out. I'm working on the architecture, the whole thing.
Why do they have to be male, please?
Well, that's true.
Well, you don't have a lot of ladies in the prog world, I gotta say.
But then, Christian, have you thought about how you would handle, what post you would take in a live show of Cosmological? Would you play both bass and six-string guitar?
I would not play bass. I mean, I would love to play bass, but if I did, I would play bass on the whole thing, and I don't want to play bass on the whole thing. I want to play guitar. So, for instance, I did figure out a way, and I can cover it if I had bass and keys and drums, just a four-piece. On a double neck, I can do architecture pretty much the whole thing.
Yeah.
Wow. That's coming across. And so that was inspirational to be just like, wait, maybe I can do this. Maybe more of these things can be pulled off with a smaller band. But of course, you know, I was also a fan of the Tubes in their heyday.
Yeah.
And you know, they had two guitarists and two keyboardists and you know, destroying rhythm section and a killer frontman in Fee. And to have all that instrumentation to choose from, and everybody is a monster player, you know, that's sort of my cream dream right there, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, here's the only requirement if you end up performing it live is make sure to give me enough advance notice so I can make airline reservations to come out and see it.
Man, if we do it, it'll take a year to get it done.
So can you tell me anything about the sequel? We talked about that a little at the top. Is there anything that you can reveal about the next prog album?
Yeah, it's harder.
Is it?
It's more difficult.
Oh, it's more difficult. Okay, I thought you were going to say, I thought you meant
No. It's much more difficult because of second album syndrome.
Well, you don't want to repeat yourself, you know?
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And so with Cosmological, I had all these, as I said, bits and bobs and pieces and motifs and what have you sitting around that I'd been sitting on for years.
Yeah.
And so just like, you know, when you hear a debut record by a band that's great. And then there's the follow-up album that's like, Yeah, that's okay. It's okay, but not like that first record, boy. It's so common to have that second that sophomore blues, and that's what I'm kind of dealing with is making sure that we're not repeating ourselves. Mm-hmm. I think it's, you know, we're looking at a little bit longer in construction. But also, Cersei is just now starting to get really into the meat and potatoes of the lyrics.
Yes, that's what I was going to ask.
Which will definitely change arrangement and structure and all of that kind of mm-hmm. stuff. All for the good, because then I go, oh man, I missed that. I thank you very much. And, you know, I'm going to slice this entire section out and move it up front. You know, that yeah. things like that happen all the time.
Because it's art. We don't put any, I mean, we want to get it out in a timely manner, but again, we're not making content, we're making art. So we really put ourselves through the paces of, does it sound great?
Yeah.
Does it stand up to the other stuff? Is it something that we feel is an improvement or is taking us further down the road, is delighting us still mm-hmm. instead of phoning it in or just repeating ourselves?
We've made a couple albums in the past. I mean, I think we got a dozen now, something like yeah. that, of original records. And there are a couple in there, we'll remain nameless, that we go, you know what? We just
could have been better.
Just didn't quite hit it on those records. And I just don't want to be there on that. And so it's going to take as long as it takes to make mm-hmm. sure that this is something I can go, I am definitely proud of this record.
Yeah, there is no bullshit on Cosmologica. Rick yeah. Wakeman famously complained about Tales from Topographic Oceans that there was a lot of bluffing or however you call it.
I agree with him. Yeah. I agree with him.
Yeah, a lot of filling time. Like, we got to fill up an entire side with this song. So let's fill up this entire side without any sort of guide as far as what to fill it up with. But with Cosmologica, it is like everything makes sense. Everything works in it. And that's one of the many myriad aspects of this album that's so great.
Yeah, there's no fat on that record.
Yeah.
You know, your acknowledgement of Tales, you know, I sometimes feel like that record is just, you know, there's probably 20 minutes of that record, if you put it all together, maybe even more, of just opportunities for Steve Howe to noodle. I know that some of your listeners are going to come just... you know, gunning for me.
I think everyone agrees to an extent with that assessment. Yeah.
But it's good noodling. And so that's, as an artist, you also have to censor yourself. You have to sometimes go back and go, oh, I love that section, but you know what? I already did probably 15 minutes too much of that.
Yeah. Well, you have to admire the ambition of it. And that's how I kind of think of Tales from Topographic Oceans, an album that had a ton of ambition. Didn't always work, but overall, I admire the fact that they, you know, stepped out and tried, as John Anderson said, try to put the Bible to music. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think the first 6-7 minutes of the first side is destroying.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's incredible, you know?
Yeah, it is.
One of the greatest themes. Are you kidding? Exactly what Yes is about. And so,
well, suffice to say, I'm going to continue pushing this album on my audience, whether they like it or not, because I believe in it so much. It is truthfully among my top five favorite prog albums of all time, if not my favorite. It has really risen to that level. Literally everything I love about prog rock is in this recording, and there's not a weak song on the entire thing. And that's going back to our discussions about bluffing a second ago.
Mm-hmm.
There is not a weak moment on this entire thing. So congratulations on this piece of music. It is wonderful in so many different ways. And I wish you both the most immense success with this. And of course, the upcoming sequel, which now I'm going to be, I'm going to be watching the clock, looking forward to this
name?
One. Yeah.
No.
Do you want to drop the name?
No, she's not going to drop the name.
No, because I'm working on the theme. I don't want to let the cat out of the bag. But I do want to say thank you for being such an amazing listener and for supporting musicians of all stripes. It takes people like you to turn each of us on to each other. It's community. It's art is about community and supporting each other and being excited for each other. And I really value value that. Thank you so much for taking the time, not just for us, but for all the other musicians that you feature on your show.
Thank Fantastic. You again. And I would love to talk to you again at some point, certainly when it comes to the next recording, whether it's the sequel, the Prague sequel, or something else that you're working on. Just let me know. Keep me updated. And you've got an open invitation to come back.
Well, if you get excited about any of the earlier records and you go, oh, you know what? Let's talk about this. And we're happy to show up.
Thank you both again. Take care.